We'll call the meeting to order of the Interim Ag and Natural Resource Committee. Welcome, everybody. Just a quick note, the agenda's quick and laid out for us. This hopefully is our last meeting of Ag Committee, and we can finalize the final report. I hope we're at the point where, are we going to be able to say the rewrite is complete?
I'm hoping.
Okay, that's what we're all hoping for, and thank you, everybody. First thing on the order, we'll have a roll call, and council?
Representative Ostad. Representative Brabant?
Here.
Representative Humsker?
Here.
Representative Johnson? Representative Johnson informed me prior to the meeting that he will not be in attendance today. Representative Kiefert?
Here.
Representative Larson?
Here.
Representative Trottier?
Here.
Senator Look?
Here.
Senator Bowman?
Here.
Senator Erbley?
Here.
Senator Miller also informed me prior to the meeting that he is running just a couple minutes late, but he will be here. And Senator Murphy?
Here.
Your quorum.
Thank you, Council. First consideration is the minutes of the last meeting. Do we have any motions to approve? We have a motion approved. Do we have a second? Second from Senator Murphy. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, minutes are approved from the last meeting. We'll go to our 10:05, our legislative draft for special allocations for hunting licenses. Council?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, the draft before you is the third run at this. The committee has been through it in detail a couple of occasions prior. There were some suggested changes at the prior meeting, and I will just highlight those unless somebody sees something that looks hinky. So let's leap over to page 5. On lines 5 and 6, this is the Wild Sheep Foundation raffle or auction, and on line 12, I think we only had raffle listed, so now it's raffle or auction. Just a correction there that was pointed out. Then, if you look on page 6, beginning on line 15, in subsection 7, there we have raffle or auction.
Excuse me, Council, does everybody have that draft?
Are you on the first tab?
Oh, isn't that in the binders?
Yeah, it's in the binders. It's your tab. It's number 121 at the back of your binder, and we're on the 3000 version.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay, sorry about that. They didn't let me have a binder, so I was. No problem.
Okay, you might want to start us over again.
Okay, on 5, page 5. 3000 version, yep. On line 12, it says raffle or auction, and I think in the 02 version it only said raffle there, but up on lines 5 and 6, it says raffle or auction, so it just needed to be made consistent. On page 6, there was no change here, but the Mule Foundation grandfathered provision, that is also one that can be done by raffle or auction, and there are three references in here. And then if you look at page 6 down on line 27, the Hunter Educators Association, that one is limited to raffle only. So there are differences for some of these license holders. Beginning on page 7, that whole first section is what we're referring to as the grandfathered organizations that have already been through the legislative process and gained approval. Now they're all in that first section. Now on page 7, line 22, we start the second section of this chapter, and this is discretionary special allocation license authorization. These are the licenses that may be approved by the department, and they are limited to line 24, the director may authorize issuance of the following, so it's not mandatory that all of these licenses be issued every year. The first one is not more than 2 elk license, second one not more than 2 moose license, then there are 2 antelope license and up to 10 white-tailed deer license. Now I want to point out something that I came across in here that just did not add up right. In subsection 3 on page 8, eligible organization that obtains a license may conduct a raffle or auction to determine the recipient. Raffle or auction mentioned again. Down at the bottom of that sub 3, the sentence says, if an individual receives a license under this section, the individual can't get an elk or moose license through the lottery. Okay, that's a mistake, because you can get an elk or moose license under this section, but you could also get antelope or white-tailed deer license, and that should not disqualify you from the elk or moose lottery. So, on line 17, my suggestion is the word A should be replaced with the words an elk or moose, so that it would be, if you get an elk or moose license under this section, you can't get elk or moose through the game and fish lottery. And then the last phrase in that same sentence says, if you get, now it would be an elk or moose license, you can't get an elk or moose license under subsection 1. Well, that's stupid. Subsection 1 is how you get the license that makes you ineligible to get that license. It's, what it should say is, if you get an elk or moose license under this section, you cannot also get an elk or moose license from one of those grandfathered organizations that year. So, to fix it, at the end of the sentence where it says subsection 1, that should be struck out and replaced by section 20.1-05.1-01. And that's the section that has the grandfathered organization licenses. So if you get an elk or moose under this special allocation optional, you can't also get one from a grandfathered organization, and you can't get one through the game and fish lottery. You can only have one a year. Now, there was something mentioned at the prior meeting about considering requiring recipient organizations to be North Dakota organizations, and some of these organizations are not based in North Dakota, but they have a chapter here. And on lines 27 and 28, there is a provision that an organization has to be on file as a nonprofit corporation in good standing in the Secretary of State's office. So they are at least registered to function in North Dakota. And that's probably as much restriction as there could be consistent with some of the entities that are already grandfathered. then there, I don't know if there was any consideration, but recipients, whether they have to be resident or non-resident, right now it's open, and it's probably appropriate to leave it that way. If somebody from England wants to throw down $1 million to come and hunt in North Dakota, okay. Okay, the good news is there aren't any other changes to look at. So, if it is agreeable to the committee, in the form it is, it would be necessary to have a motion to make those amendments that I suggested and to approve and recommend the bill draft. And that could all be done in one motion, so we don't have to vote twice. But I suppose first we should see if the folks from the department are okay with the way these changes would be added and the other contents.
Well, first of all, committee members, any thoughts before we bring up Representative Some Game and Fish? Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, committee, and John, on section 3, when you're talking about it should be an instead of a, it's done throughout most of the section already. Is it, where would it need to be added? On page 8.
On page on section 3. 8 in sub 3. On line 17, where the language says, if an individual receives a license under this section, and it should be restricted to elk or moose license. So the word a would be replaced with an elk or moose.
Oh, before, okay, all right. Right after receives a, should be receives
an elk or moose. Elk or moose. Okay. Yeah, that's the problem. It's
all right. Thank you.
If I understand that correct, Senator, the change is important because it would also cancel out a person's qualifications for a antelope or something else. That's why it's clarified. Is that correct?
Yeah. If you get an antelope license under this section, it should not disqualify you from an elk or moose license. It's the elk or moose license that disqualifies you.
Right. Any individuals from Game and Fish want to just make a final comment and overview of the bill draft?
Are we on? Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Scott Peterson, Deputy Director at North Dakota Game and Fish, and I guess unless there are specific questions, the one comment that I would make is, first of all, we appreciate the assistance of legal counsel in drafting a bill that we feel is a very good draft, and we're comfortable with the changes that Mr. Walstead suggested this morning. We're comfortable with presenting this to the full assembly, and we think it meets the intent of the legislative study, and we also recognize that there's probably going to be some debate as we go forward, but yeah, we're comfortable with the draft as it is with the changes that Mr. Walstead suggested.
Okay, committee members, any questions? Just Scott, a quick. The real change here is basically when it came to a session or so on, somebody would present a bill. Now what we've put in place here is that if somebody would like to make a request, it's going to kind of get cleared a little bit of the hurdles through Game and Fish first, and then it'll come back to legislative say. Is that basically correct?
Mr. Chairman, I guess our understanding would be that if you folks approve this, and of course the bill is ultimately drafted, that there really, it takes the onus off of the General Assembly. There would really be no need for you folks to review that on an annual basis, and that's kind of the intent here, is that, you know, in the past we would get one or two or three, and then the burden would fall on the assembly to determine who's worthy and who's not, and it puts all of us in kind of a tough spot. And so this would remove that. It doesn't preclude somebody from coming in and presenting one, but again, then you folks could say, well, we have a process in place. Let's follow that process. That would be my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hunsker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if an entity applies for the elk or moose license, you would use your administrative rules to determine who would be eligible or who might receive a license. Is that basically what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunsker, yeah, that's correct. We would, obviously, we're going to have to draft, again, assuming that this goes forward and is passed, we would draft some administrative rules to determine who's eligible, and some of that's already spelled out, that the organization to be eligible would have to meet 501c3 requirements and have a presence in North Dakota, which is already spelled out in there. And then 10% of the proceeds of that raffle would go to a conservation project in North Dakota as approved by the director of North Dakota Game and Fish. But yes, basically you're correct. We'd have to draft some administrative rules, but.
Okay, thank you, Scott. Members, we're.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Hate to do this, just occurred to me. We closed one door, but we left another one open. The language in this suggested amendment would provide that if an individual gets an elk or moose license under this section, that individual can't get one from one of the grandfathered organizations. The door that's still open is if you get one from a grandfathered organization, you shouldn't also be able to get one here. So to fix that, in that sub 3 on line 20, I think we need a new sentence that says, if an individual receives an elk or moose license under section 50, section 20.1-05.1-01, that individual may not obtain an elk or moose license under this section. So then we would have a provision: if you get one in the lottery, you don't get one of these under either case. If you get one here, you can't get one through the lottery or the grandfathered organizations, but we need this so that if you get one from a grandfathered organization, you can't also get one here. I think that closes all the doors.
Counsel, so in your best interpretation, person's only eligible for one.
Under any circumstance, can't shop around and come up with three licenses or two.
I keep trying, though.
Well,
yes, Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Couldn't we simplify that a little bit? Couldn't we just say you're only entitled to, in any case, you're only entitled to one per year? No, by any means? I mean, do we have to keep referring back and forth to different chapters?
Council's thinking about that.
I can hear that word. I can hear that word.
Yeah. We're looking at over 30 years of experience in legislative council here coming to an end.
I would be more comfortable having these references to that section and this section and the lottery. I think that leaves no room for interpretation.
Good question. Under advisement of the council, they will stay the same. So if there's not any further discussion, we'll look for a motion to amend the current changes that we talked about, and then further move it to pass the bill as amended.
I would so move.
Senator Murphy moves. Do we have a second? The senator from Senator Lewick. Any further discussion? If not, we will have the roll.
Representative Robbins.
Yes.
Representative Hunsker?
Yes.
Representative Johnson? Not here. Representative Kiefer?
Yes.
Representative Larson?
Yes.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
We're voting on the amendments, right? Yeah.
We are voting on the motion is a recommendation from council. We're voting on the amendment.
Yeah.
And then we're further passing in the bill as amended. So we're doing this all in one swoop.
Okay.
Okay.
Representative Trottier.
Yes.
Senator Lewick.
Yes.
Senator Bowman.
Yes.
Senator Erbley.
Yes.
Senator Miller.
No.
Senator Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Onstead, Chairman Onstead.
Yes. Motion carried.
Motion carries. Sorry, that was my first one.
Well, that was good. Motion carried. Okay. We'll move on to our next session.
All right.
Council, 1035. Actions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the next several drafts all deal with livestock auction markets. The first one we are dealing with is number 29 in your tabs, and we are talking about the 5,000 version now. This deals with financial transactions at livestock auction markets. And specifically, this draft deals with section 36-21-18. This section was previously a part of the rewrite of the entire chapter 36-21 on general livestock provisions. And you as a committee previously approved the rewrite of the entire chapter, but this section was cut out separately to be looked at with a little bit more scrutiny so that we could work with industry personnel to ensure that the section reflected modern practices. So, at the last meeting, you saw this section, but we were directed to work with the Stockman's Association and other industry personnel on additional language changes. So with that in mind, the only specific change that I would like to point out on this draft is, at the request of Ms. Julie Ellingson and the Stockman's Association, we amended the language on lines 13 and 14 at the bottom of the draft to include language which says, for a non-cash purchase and transfer of title. Previously, in the 4,000 version, the language just said for the purchase to be valid. And the thought with the additional added language there is that a cash purchase would automatically make the transfer of title valid because the transaction is completed immediately. So there's no need to specify, a cash purchase. So we included the non-cash purchase language in there. And the recommendation from the Stockman Association was that by adding the language regarding the non-cash purchase, it removes the need to include the language on lines 15 through 17 because that becomes a little bit redundant. It that talks about where the title remains until the transfer has been completed and the title actually transfers to the buyer. So it implies that with the language as it is now, for non-cash purchase and transfer title to be valid, the financial institution of the purchaser must honor the payment at the time of presentation. That implies that at that point, the transfer of title is valid, and if the financial institution does not honor the payment, then the title would remain in the buyer. It doesn't transfer to the seller at that point. So, like I said, Stockman Association was of the suggestion that there's no need to include the language in lines 15 through 17. So everything else should remain the same. There's just a little added language on lines 13 and 14, and then the removal of the language on lines 15 through 17. And if there are any questions regarding that, I would be happy to answer them. And I believe we do have a representative from the Stockings Association here as well.
Members, any comments? The changes reflect modern day practices and terminology, what got left and so on, so it brings things up to date. Comments from the Stockmans at all? We're okay? Okay. Members, will, is this considered our first reading? Do we have to?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no, this draft was viewed at the last meeting, so this would be the second time through on this draft. You know, there was, just going back in the minutes, there was some discussion as to whether or not these would be considered substantive changes, but I know through discussions with the Stockmen's Association, they and we were also under the impression that this is just cleaning up obsolete language and making it reflect modern business practices. So we were of the impression that this would not be substantive, and this is under the purview of what the committee is trying to do here. So this could be reinserted back into the rewrite of the chapter in its entirety with these changes placed in there. So that way there wouldn't have to be a separate bill draft brought during session just for this section.
Okay, so if there's no further questions, we're of acceptance or of mind to accept this. All we need is a voice vote.
Mr. Chairman, the practice as we have been working through these is that at some point when the committee feels comfortable that the bill does what needs to be done, it gets moved into the grain bin pile.
Right.
When we're finished, we'll probably have 35 bills
right
in that pile. And at the end of the meeting, we will have a suggestion of how to avoid 35 roll call votes. Okay. So I would suggest that if this is agreeable with the committee, you could just instruct that this amendment be added to the main bill, and that the main bill with that change then be grain binned.
Okay. Members, all understanding of that process, if there isn't any further questions or comments, we will move this to the second tier. Counselor, next agenda.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the next draft that we are looking at is tab 136. And, give me one second here. We are looking at the 2000 version of this draft. And this draft deals with just the regular livestock auction markets. At the last meeting, we reviewed this chapter. This is the second viewing. And there aren't a lot of changes in this one. The main point of discussion actually on this draft at the last meeting was that there was some discussion on the definition of livestock throughout the Century Code. There are a number of definitions of livestock throughout the Century Code, and they are all slight variations of one another. And there was consideration of trying to rewrite all the definitions to make them all uniform. However, after some discussion between Mr. Walstead and myself, as well as the Department of Agriculture and the state veterinarian, we decided that maybe that was a can of worms that we maybe should not have opened. And the reason that I say that is because all the definitions of livestock in the Century Code were written specific to their respective chapters. And we have concern that, well, creating a uniform definition would be a convenience. It also may alter the intent of the drafters for those specific chapters. So for that reason, we, at least at this point, opted not to create a uniform definition of livestock. We just thought that that may screw up how livestock is viewed within the individual chapters. So we did not make that change at this point. So that was the main point of discussion in this chapter at the last meeting. The only other amendment that was made in this draft from the 1000 version is there was a 1969 grandfathering provision regarding veterinarians on page 8, lines 18 and 19. And at the request and suggestion of Dr. Keller, the state veterinarian, we removed that grandfathering provision as being obsolete. It's no longer in use or necessary. So that was the only language change that was made to this draft on page 8, lines 18 and 19. But I wanted to point out that while there was discussion on making a uniform definition of livestock, we at least at this point opted not to do so because of the concerns of altering the intent of the drafters of the various definitions in the individual chapters themselves. And with that, that's any questions that you may have, I'd be happy to attempt.
Thank you, council members. Comments? If none, we will move this to the next level.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the last draft that we have regarding livestock auction markets is on tab 95. And once again, we are looking at the 2000 version of this bill draft. This one should be pretty quick and easy. This bill draft deals with satellite video auction markets, and like I said, this is the second run through on this bill draft. The only change that was made in this bill draft since the last meeting with the recommendation of the Stockings Association was the removal of all references to the word satellite. It was discussed that satellite may no longer be an accurate description of how auction markets are viewed with advances in technology. So all references in this bill draft now simply refer to video auction markets as opposed to satellite video auction markets. And we feel that that terminology may more accurately encompass the fact that auction markets can be viewed through a number of different visual mediums that don't necessarily include the use of a satellite. So that's all that happened in this bill draft.
Okay. Thank you, council members. Thoughts, comments? If none, we'll move this one forward.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, moving briskly along, and this one shouldn't slow things down. I don't know the tab.
Okay, so we are now on 61, and it's the 3000 version.
Okay, if you have found the draft, you can't write a bill much shorter than this. It's just to repeal the chapter on unfair discrimination of the purchase of farm products. At the previous meeting, the committee looked at a draft that cleaned up the whole chapter, so all the language was laid out for review. And then we had some discussion about whether this law still has any point in North Dakota. The conclusion was that there's really nothing in it that is of much use and that repeal would be appropriate. Apparently that it's obsolete in modern agricultural trade practice, so it's just a repeal.
Questions, comments? Yes, Senator Bowman?
No.
Nope. Okay, move it forward.
John, you got Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the next draft is on soil conservation districts, and it is tab 88, and it is the 2000 version.
That one's good again, John. Okay, this draft is the opposite of as short as a bill draft can be. It's about as long a chapter as you could come up with to describe soil conservation districts, but that's the topic. The bill draft is the second version. There were some notes in this one, but it's still intended as cleanup only. But there are some things I would point out that are just kind of odd. On page 2, there's a change to the definition, actually elimination of the definition of petition. The definition says it's to create a district, but throughout the chapter, petition is used repeatedly for creating a district, but also expanding a district, nominating someone for supervisor, seeking a variance, all kinds of other things. And when it's used in those ways, it's clear what it's intended to do. So it's wrong to describe it as just this one purpose. So I just took out the definition. It's pretty clear what's going on when a petition is required. Let's see here. Let's skip along a little here. We certainly don't want to read this whole thing because I'm sure everybody has done that in between meetings. Hearings on petitions. Beginning at the bottom of page 6. There's a procedure here if someone files a petition to establish a soil conservation district. On page 7, if the committee determines on facts at the hearing and whatever else they find out that there is a need for a district in the area, it records that determination and defines the district. Down at the bottom of page 7, line 26, if the committee determines after the hearing and consideration of the facts that there's no need for a district, they shall record that determination and deny the petition. So there are two places here where the committee can put a stop to the idea of establishing a district. Then there is an election on page 8. The election is held, and due notice and so on. Then the qualified electors in the area get to vote, and then the results of the election are determined. Then at the bottom of page 8, there's a section. The committee publishes the results of the election. If a majority are in favor, the committee shall determine whether that's administratively feasible. If they decide it's not, no district. So to me, it's really kind of foolish to have an election and then have a committee that can say, well, no, it's not going to be good. They made that determination before they called the election. They have the election, and then they get another chance to say, nah, no good. So anyway, we can't really change it because it would certainly be substantive, but I just wanted to point out that's kind of a stupid procedure. Let's see, nothing really on 9, 10, 11, 12. Most of this is cleanup stuff. Page 17, subsection 17 of this lengthy section of the powers of a district. This is the one about levying taxes. And on line 15, general fund levy not exceeding 2.5 mils. Okay. Nothing unusual about that, and it fits into the scheme of things. But if you remember on page 18, there is a reference on line 3, that's subdivision E, voter-approved levy authority that was approved before 2015 remains in effect through the year 2024 or whatever time was authorized by the voters. That looks odd because there's nothing in here in current law that allows them to go to the voters for a levy increase. But there used to be. Prior to the 2015 bill that took away a lot of those unlimited levy votes, there was authority. It is now gone, but this subdivision is there to honor any voters' approved excess levy for 10 years, and then it's done. Page 18, There is a reference here to referendum, and it is used all through the rest of this chapter to describe an election. And we all have a different idea of what a referendum is. It's not just any election, it's an election that says no dice to some proposal that has been enacted. So, throughout the chapter, I've changed those references from referendum to election. Shouldn't cause anybody any concern. On page 19, section 27 of the bill, adoption of ordinances. And again, this isn't really something we can change, but I want to point it out. Ordinance approved by the qualified electors, and then if you read down a little, it's binding. Once an ordinance by a district has been approved by the voters, it's binding on all qualified electors living in the district. Okay, the problem with that is it's not binding on all the property in the district, it's just binding on qualified electors. So if someone owns land in the district but resides elsewhere, that land is not subject to those restrictions, technically. Again, not something we can change, but something maybe to bear in mind. Personally, I think it's a drafting goof, but then on page 21, if you remember at the last meeting when we were going through this, I expressed some frustration with one particular section that contained the longest sentence on earth, and anyway, I quit pouting and fixed it. So, bottom of page 21, this thing that used to be one sentence is now broken down so you can kind of chew your way through it in smaller bites. So it's laid out in subsections and subdivisions. Hopefully a little more user-friendly than what we had before, but not really making changes in anything, just breaking it into pieces. Page 25. Taking testimony at a hearing. I'm afraid I may have made a substantive change here, but I think it would be foolish not to. The current section says if there's a hearing, The testimony must be taken in shorthand, and the person requesting the testimony has to pay the shorthand reporter. What I did was just cross that out and put in the provisions that apply to administrative hearings. If you have an administrative hearing, you have an option. You can have the testimony recorded by a court reporter, a stenographer, or an electronic recording device. And I think it's 100% electronic recording device because it doesn't cost $500. So, pardon me if that's a substantive change, but I think it's an improvement. Let's see. Oh, bottom of page 25. About appeals. There's language in here about what the court can do on an appeal, and I just struck that out. It's already covered in other laws. There are all kinds of provisions. If you appeal to the court system from the decision of a local governing body, there is a procedure that is laid out. And that procedure is essentially what is in this provision, except it's got more detail and makes more sense to use what courts are used to. So, let's see. Oh, now here's another thing about referendums. Oops, there's a referendum I didn't cross out. On bottom of page 27, if there's an election to discontinue a district, now once again, it has an odd result. On line 23, if a majority of the votes cast in the, and that word referendum should be overstruck and changed to election, favor discontinuing the district, the committee shall consider that, and if it determines it's not feasible, shall record that determination. And then if they decide, well, continued operation is feasible, petition's denied. So once again, we've had an election that can be overruled. And then down at the bottom of page 27, in making its determination, the committee shall give due weight and regard to the number and attitudes of qualified electors. How do you do that? That guy looked kind of angry.
Mr. Chairman.
Question, Mr. Chairman. Yep.
Senator.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Walsh said, is that reference to the committee, the state committee?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's just what I wanted to clarify. And
yeah.
So the state committee is all knowing and all powerful then?
To an incredible degree. I mean, I've never seen anything like this. They can veto the thing before it gets off the ground, or they can let an election be held, and then, regardless of the election results, they can still say no.
And just further resolve that, I mean, that's what currently is there. We're not in a position to change that, and I think it's something that could very well be discussed further, or any of the members look at. And it's even like going back to page 19 when we talked about that. And if I can get that cleared up, basically, if they approved, if you're not a resident, although you own land in that district, if you're not a resident of that particular district, and they approve an ordinance, that ordinance does not affect your property.
It does not affect you, and it does not apply to your property, Leaf. As your attorney, that's what I would argue.
Because you're not a resident. Senator Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was also going to ask a question on page 19, on line 25, if that's appropriate now. The one you just referenced?
Yes.
John, would you suggest possibly something like line 25 should read, are binding and obligatory upon all property within the district?
To me, that would make a lot more sense. What if there's only one qualified elector? Most of the land is owned by someone else.
Right.
Yeah.
Would that be suggested language just to
qualified
electors
living? If we were free to rewrite this the way we think makes sense, yes.
Okay.
But to me, making a change there would be substantive.
I understand that. I'm just looking for, you know, possible legislation coming up, so I wanted to make sure that.
Well,
especially if on the floor we said that you were responsible for thinking about it, it would pass easily.
Thank you, Senator.
It hasn't always been the case.
And members, I think it's important to understand that if this changes, you'll have knowledge of why something is brought forward, because under current practices, it really doesn't seem to apply. Maybe a better explanation from the Soil Conservation District part of that, but as well, everybody that lives out in the country, the landowners are spread far and near, and it seems an ordinance does not affect you if you're not a resident of that particular district. Seems to be odd. But then they were, I'm guessing the thoughts were because they weren't able to vote for or against that because they're not a resident of that. I don't know if that, and doesn't work from city to city, I don't think, as you might own lots in several cities or something like that. So, okay. Any other comments or questions?
Mr. Chairman, just a point. It was mentioned that hearing from the soil conservation folks might be helpful. I sent this bill prior to the last meeting and prior to this meeting to the association and never heard back from anybody. I was told that it was going to be distributed to the interested parties, but haven't received any input. Now, point of order, I guess. This committee's charge is non-substantive revision. Once this bill has been introduced, that rule no longer applies, and changing things to make sense is fair game.
Right, right. And it's
makes sense.
It's really been helpful, the fact that rewrites are done periodically, because you come across things that are in question, and I'm assuming that practice is not read to the law that's currently being practiced from both local soil conservation districts and the state district, and you assume you make a change, it affects everybody. So I think it'd be worthwhile any member of this committee to approach soil conservation district at the state level or even local level and get their comments on it. So any other questions, members? If not, we will we'll move this forward as changes we have. Senator Lewick?
I just wonder if you just completed.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Lewick, I think. There was another election there that's not binding on whether the district continues or not. And there is, again on page 30, the question of consolidating districts. And that would be decided by an election. And if a majority are for consolidation, the state committee, certifies that they're consolidated. So to consolidate districts, they don't get to say no. But to establish a district or discontinue a district, they do get to say no to the election result. So anyway, this law was enacted in 1937, and I'm guessing this group might be the first group since 1937 to read the whole thing.
Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Senator Lewick had a point to bring up, too.
Mr. Chairman, on page 30, line 18, I'm just wondering how close that requirement is being followed today.
Which
$5 a...
Oh, yeah, I flagged that one. $5. 37, that was probably not bad nowadays.
Yep. So there's some opportunity for any members here to look at future legislation and discussion. If no further comments, we will... move this. Okay, Senator Miller.
Mr. Chairman, in regard to that election stuff, I think
all these elections generally are done on the primary ballot or general ballot or something like that. So I think the county just takes care of it. I don't even think they do anything anymore. They just put their name on the ballot. So somebody's missing out on $5.
I agree, you know, that every time there's a different name for a soil conservation district. And I will know some districts are very active, some districts are not very active, like water resource boards. Some are on top of everything, and some are just really, really lax at that point. But point well taken, Senator. Any other comments? If not, we will move this forward and go to the next agenda item.
Mr. Chairman, the next draft is miscellaneous.
And for your reference, it's tab 98 in the binder, and it's the 2000 version.
The committee has looked at this draft previously and approved it for placement in final form version, and that's the draft before you. It's 98.02. All of the language is now underscored. You can see it's creating a new chapter, 4.154. I still can't think of a better name for this chapter than miscellaneous agriculture laws, because that's what it is. It's been the place where laws have ended up that didn't seem to fit in any of the other chapters on agriculture. And if you flip through it, we've got North Dakota Ag Hall of Fame, reports from Ag Commodity Promotion Groups, investment income from various commodity assessment funds, purple coneflowers, and I'm still puzzled why echinacea is protected. Well, anyway, then genetic modified products and so on. So I don't have any other comments. I didn't notice anything going through it again that looked fishy. So.
Okay. Members? If not, we will go to the next agenda item.
Mr. Chairman, this draft relates to the state forester and forestry, tree distribution, things like that. It's LC 88 would be the tab, right?
Oh, I'm sorry, no, it's 83.
83. Yep, 83, and it's the 0.02 version. Second draft, this is a draft the committee looked at the prior meeting and requested that it be placed in final form, and that's what this draft does. It puts it in as a brand new chapter of the new title on ag. I again sent this version to the state forester for review, and he communicated back that he is comfortable that this does what current law does and doesn't really make any changes. So he didn't have any suggestions on doing anything differently than what's in the draft.
Okay. Thank you, council members. If not, we will approve this, and we will move on to the 1 o'clock.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we are way ahead of schedule. We are now looking at the anhydrous ammonia draft, and that is number 40 in your tabs.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Murphy.
I'm glad we're way ahead. I don't want to hold us up too much, but just on the last one, if that's a brand new chapter, how do we explain to people if there are protests on the floor, how is that not substantive if it's a brand new chapter?
It's really not appropriate, I guess, to say it's a brand new chapter. It's transplanting the existing law into the new Title 4.1. And it's being done with no substantive change. There has been language cleaned, but it's intended that the way the law works would still be the same. It's just now going to be located in a new place, and we will not be in the position we're in now where some ag laws are in one title and some are in another because of this. Yeah.
Thank you.
And somebody will probably ask that, so.
No, thank you for the explanation. Okay, we'll go to Section 40.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, as I was saying, the next chapter is anhydrous ammonia, and that is number 40 in your tabs. And at the last meeting, we looked at the 2000 version of this bill, and just for clarification, we are now on the 4000 version. There is a 3000 version in the binders, but there were some additional requests for changes to this draft after we finished the 3000 version, so we created a 4000. So 3000 is irrelevant at this point. Just a couple of things to point out on this one. This is we've seen this draft before, so there aren't a lot of changes, but there are a couple that I do want to point out. The only change from the last meeting that was directed by the committee was to add clarifying language as to who is and who is not allowed to repair storage and nurse tanks, and that item was number 8 on the bottom of page 8, and it's talking about prohibited acts. In the previous version, that prohibited act just said it is prohibited to make repairs or additions of appurtenances directly to pressurized storage containers or nurse tanks. And the discussion was had that, you know, that doesn't really say who can and cannot repair those tanks. So after consulting with both the department or with the Department of Agriculture as well as the chief boiler inspector, we added the language by any individual not authorized under rules adopted by the commissioner. And that language was chosen because after conversations with both representatives from the Department of Agriculture as well as the chief boiler inspector, it was determined that who is and who is not authorized to make those repairs is already laid out under the administrative rules under 7-12-01-04.8. And if you look prior to the 4000 version draft, you'll see email correspondence between myself and the chief boiler inspector. And that was just to give you some reference as to the conversation that I had with him, where he laid out that under that number 8 in that administrative rule, it does say that welded repairs or alterations to pressurized storage containers can only be made by a firm in possession of a valid R certificate of authorization from the National Board of Boiler and Pressure Vessel Inspectors. So by saying that only a person authorized under rules established by the commissioner, it then references to the administrative rules where you can find who is and who is not authorized to make repairs to those vessels. So that was the one point of discussion that was had at the last meeting to clarify that. The only other item that changed here, and this was not a directive from the committee, but at the last meeting, we had inserted language regarding the chief boiler inspector being included on licensing and siting requirements. And as I was having the discussion on the storage tanks, it was brought to my attention that the insurance department and the chief boiler inspector in previous sessions have been removed from the licensing and siting requirements, and that is now completely under the authority of the Department of Agriculture. And at the last meeting, we had reinserted the chief boiler inspector into those sections, and those sections are Section 4 on page 3 and Section 6 on page 5. And after discussions with the insurance department, they indicated that they no longer have any input on licensing or siting requirements, and they did not wish to be reinserted back into those sections. So we deferred to the insurance department on that, and we removed the chief boiler inspector from those sections to not to cause any headbutting between agencies as to who has responsibility or who should have responsibility. So those are the only two changes that were made in this draft from the previous draft. And if there are any questions, I do know we have representatives from the Department of Agriculture, and I believe there were going to be representatives from the insurance department as well, but because we are so far ahead of schedule, they are not present as of right now.
Okay, thanks, Council. If they do come, like right after lunch, we'll allow them to make a statement. If you go back to page 8 on between 13 and 14, you asked the question about that question. Is it supposed to be a fund that's supposed to be specifically identified that way, or is it a budgetary item that we should put in, or what? It talks about a reference to a deposit of fees in a fund. Is there a fund where the fees are held for use?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I plugged that question in for that reason. Usually if there's a statute about fees, it says put them here, put them there. This one doesn't. So I just plugged a question in, do we need to name whatever fund, and I guess I didn't get an answer.
Would you like my checking account number?
Okay. Give me your routing and yeah.
I would too.
I think maybe Representative Mr. Delzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I think I might have some clarification on this. We'll probably need to look it up. But I believe that previously there was a reference to a fund, and I think that was repealed a couple sessions ago, or that language to that specific fund was taken out and wasn't further clarified. If my memory serves me correctly, at one point was a reference to a fund. Mr. Chairman, if I may, I guess just provide a little extra clarification on the reference to the chief boiler inspector that we had inserted in. That was one of my recommendations that I asked that it be put back in. And it was under the licensing portions of this. And my intention, I guess, was that for kind of harmonization with the insurance department's existing rules and laws, because the storage containers themselves have to be their pressure vessels that fall under their pressure vessel rules, and they have to be approved. The vessel itself has to be approved by the chief boiler inspector before we can approve it on our end and issue a license for that facility. So I was attempting just to put a reference back to them. But after talking with the insurance department, since it is really under licensing and they have nothing to do with the licensing portion of it, that I guess we kind of came to the mutual consensus that it's not really necessary to be in there. So we just asked Dustin to remove it from this draft.
Okay. Members? Just one question. Please identify yourself as for the record.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Eric Delzer. I'm the Fertilizer Program Director for the Department of Agriculture.
Okay, thank you, Eric. The chief boiler, he does approve the vessel initially.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. The way the process works is the applicant who is erecting a facility, they send an application with all of the information, all the tank data sheet, all that stuff to us. And it also needs to be approved of by the county before we can issue a license. So to keep things as simple as possible, we have them send all their information to us, and then we forward it on to the county. And then the tank information, I forward that on to the chief boiler inspector, and he'll give me an approval on it. And I guess we normally do that through email, and then I capture those emails and that approval, and then that all goes in with the documentation for the license application packet, showing that the chief boiler inspector did approve of the container before we issue a license.
But by not putting them into this, the kind of all the liabilities back on the ag department and the licensing part. If you license something, all the liability goes back on whoever is in the ag department that licensed that particular storage facility?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I guess you could probably say that. I think, you know, all the liability is on us anyway, because they apply for the application from us, and then we have to give the final approval of the facility, and we issue the license. So I think, you know, regardless, we're liable for it, and, you know, that just means that we have to do our due diligence and make sure that we're getting those other approvals as well.
And in that process, you will be using the boiler inspector basically anyway, correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Members? Any questions about... technically, we've made the changes, so we're current with... Is that the most recent, 2014, as far as we talk about the safety and practices and so on? We always reference 2014. Is that the newest? There's not a 15 or 16 or...
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The 2014 standard is the most current. Previously, we were going off of the 1989 version, and the CGA ANSI standard for anhydrous handling, that is something that's only updated as a need arises. So when members see a need to update the code, then they have to put in requests, and after they get so many requests, then they'll open it up, and there's a committee process to revise the standard. And this is only this 2014 version, which is the most current, that's only the second time it has been revised since 1989. There was a 1999 version, but we did not pursue adopting that at that time because the changes that were made were so minimal, and most of them were already addressed in our administrative rules, so we didn't feel it was necessary in 1999. But now we're up to the most current version, and okay. You know, we feel it's time to update.
Okay, Senator Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Delzer, excuse me, the federal deliberation that's been going on recently in the last few years, is anything changing in the state of North Dakota? A little different topic here, but I thought it was important to know about safety issues with these facilities handling anhydrous.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lewick, in North Dakota, I guess, you know, this is the first we've really looked at updating any codes or any rules in anhydrous ammonia storage and handling. There's been a lot of talk about it federally, as you're pointing out, and a lot of that goes back to, you know, recent executive orders signed by the president after the West Texas explosion. There's been a lot of scrutiny over anhydrous ammonia. Currently, OSHA has revised their standards for anhydrous ammonia, and they've incorporated a lot of these facilities, or they're attempting to incorporate them under their process safety management standard. Also federally, the EPA's risk management program, they've proposed new rules that would affect these anhydrous ammonia storage facilities in the state, and that is something that we would have to enforce if those rules go into effect, because we have a delegation with EPA Region 8 to enforce the risk management program for ag ammonia facilities in North Dakota. And, you know, some other changes coming up, the chemical facility anti-terrorism standards, they're looking to make updates to that. So there is a lot of stuff going on federally regarding ag chemicals in general. As far as things that are going to affect us in our state, you know, it's going to affect all the facilities, but as far as, you know, our department and what we regulate and what we have to do, the only one that would add more to our duties and responsibilities would be changes to the EPA's risk management program. There are proposed rules out, as I said. The comment period is closed. The commissioner did put in comment on that, but I think right now they're reviewing the comments, you know, going through responses, so it'll probably be quite a while before we see a final rule come out on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any other additional comments or questions? Yes, Senator Miller.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Delzer, just kind of continuing on that last question, this would be hard for you to answer, but could you in any way illustrate for us what the costs could be to retailers of anhydrous ammonia in North Dakota to perhaps comply with these proposed rules?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, I would be happy to do my best on that. We did send out, when OSHA first came out with their policy change last year, which would incorporate all these facilities under their process safety management standard, we did do some work on that. We sent out a request for information to industry members around the state. We also consulted with some of the safety consulting companies that write these programs for these facilities. And, you know, and we also talked with nationally with the national organizations, ag retailers, the Fertilizer Institute, and just to incorporate these facilities into the process safety management standard under OSHA, which is the big one that's really being contested right now. There's a lot of back and forth even in Congress on this. There's lawsuits pending, and just to add that part to it, we're looking at what we're seeing is a total actual cost per facility in North Dakota, $30,000 to $50,000 per facility. And you know, in talking to my peers nationally in other states, it's around those same lines. So, and then if the EPA proposed rule, you know, if they come out with a final rule based on what was in the proposed rule, you know, that is just going to add on to that probably another maybe $5,000 to $10,000 per facility. You know, and then there's companies in the state that have up to 6, 7, 8 facilities. So they're looking at major investments, and as a result, just due to the cost, we've had, I believe it's about 14 facilities in the state shut down already. Minnesota has had 23 facilities shut down. We've had a number of other facilities indicate that they're probably going to shut down before October 1st, which is when OSHA will begin enforcement of this process safety management standard. Currently, most facilities are just kind of waiting to see if any congressional action is going to happen to stop this from being implemented. But if they go forward as planned on October 1st, we will likely see more facilities in the state close down just due to the costs. And, you know, some of these facilities are smaller, rural, remote facilities, and they just don't move enough product a year to, you know, hardly justify keeping it open currently, and then you add on that extra cost. And
Senator Lewick.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Delzer, statewide and even in other states, has there been a rash of problems as far as safety violations or accidents or things that justify some changes through OSHA or EPA?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lewick, to answer that question, no, there has not been. What prompted all of this is Executive Order 13650 that was signed by President Obama in August of 2013, and that was after the West Texas chemical plant explosion. And there was a number of directives in that executive order. But the main one that is bringing all this about is he ordered all the major federal agencies to go through and revise and update and modernize all of their rules pertaining to chemical facility storage. So this is in response to that executive order. So OSHA previously had a retail exemption that the way it was written back in
1992, when that standard came out. They wrote in a retail exemption, but they did not define what retail was. So there were some letters of interpretation that said if a facility made, if they sold more than 50% of their chemical product to an end user, they would classify or fall under this exemption. And that's the way they've operated for the last 20 some years. But now, as a result of this executive order, OSHA has stated, you know, when they look back at the rule, they said, well, that interpretation of the agency is not in line with the original intent of the rule under the Clean Air Act. So they've rescinded that interpretation, and they've issued this new policy interpretation that states that only facilities that sell chemicals in small packages or quantities would qualify for that retail exemption. So essentially what they did, through the issuance of a guidance document, they incorporated 3,800 anhydrous ammonia retail facilities nationwide under this process safety management standard, you know, which is going to be a cost of, you know, $20,000 to $30,000 to $50,000 per facility.
Senator Lewick.
Let me continue, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Delzer, then, what about the end user? Is there any restrictions or requirements at the handling point of the application of anhydrous ammonia in the field, or is there, is it just basically the end or the distributors?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lewick, there is nothing that would pertain to the end user or the farmer. This simply what this would do under this new OSHA rule, it changes the safety program for that facility. Their written safety program they have to have, which is already a binder about this thick, and it's going to double that. And it's going to change the way they do some of their maintenance and inspection and testing, you know, and some of those costly things there. But for the most part, all this policy change does is changes what they are required to do for their written safety program. And, you know, the Ag Commissioner has been very outspoken, you know, against this, along with our congressional delegation, because this adds so much more work and so much more cost to the facility, but there's no discernible benefit to the workers of those facilities. So it's very unreasonable.
Senator Bowman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Delzer. Say everything was followed to the T, but there's still an accident, something happened. Who's liable? Is it the people that set up the rules and regulations and all this? Is it the company, the manufacturer, the tanks? Who actually holds the liability on something like this? Because we change rules all the time and it doesn't seem like it solves a problem. So where is the liability on something like anhydrous?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the liability, the main liability resides with the facility. They have a responsibility to design, build, and maintain a safe facility. That being said, you know, the storage container, if it were to fail, you know, possibly that could be some liability back onto the company that created the storage container. If there's an issue, again, the overall responsibility is with the facility, but there could be some liability, say, on the department if we, you know, inspected them and missed something and that caused, you know, a major accident, that could put liability back onto us. But, you know, essentially the main liability rests with the owner of that facility who stores and handles the hazardous chemical.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Miller.
I'm going to kind of deviate from Mr. Delzer, but you can certainly chime in. But since I'm not going to be here in the next session, I just, and maybe this is too little too late or unnecessary altogether, but I would think that it'd be a good idea for the legislative body to consider maybe expansion of the loan programs to the Bank of North Dakota or some kind of grant program to help these facilities update their safety to comply with this, because having fewer access points for this material, anhydrous ammonia, and having them spaced further apart just creates a greater hazard to the public. It doesn't help anyone. It makes it worse because now you got to drive further distances, and you're going to have wheels going out and bearings failing, and people having fatigue from driving at 20 miles an hour for 40 miles. So I think it'd be useful for the legislature to consider something. It might be too late. I mean, they'll probably all be closed by then, but, I'm just throwing that out there.
Good. Those are good thoughts, Senator Miller. Representative Kiefert, you've got a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what we're really looking at here is the fourth phase out of anhydrous is what we're really looking at, isn't it, for the federal government?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiefert, I guess it would be easy to draw that conclusion. It almost seems like that's what they're trying to do, in a sense. This OSHA standard that they're trying to force on these facilities, it's designed for facilities like chemical manufacturing and like large refineries, where there's hundreds of workers present, multiple hazardous chemicals in different locations in different quantities. And, I don't know how you can operate a facility of that scale without a rule like this safely. But it does not apply, to a small single process, 30,000 gallon storage tank out in the middle of the countryside that only has a worker present a couple weeks out of the year. So that's, where we keep questioning OSHA on this. But, one could draw that conclusion that they are trying to force anhydrous ammonia out. What we've tried to illustrate to OSHA and Washington and what the industry in general is trying to put out as well is that, as Senator Miller said, this is actually creating more risks than it's addressing. Like I stated earlier, we can't find any discernible worker benefit or protection or safety that this is going to add. And it increases the risks, all the, the secondary trickle-down risks, we're seeing as a result with facilities going out. Farmers are now looking to purchase their own semi-tanker trailers and do downloading out in the field. And, what that essentially does is it's taking that point of transfer operation out of the hands of a trained operator in a safe, well-regulated facility and putting it in a private user's hands basically all over the countryside. And another thing we've seen is a lot of these facilities are selling out to farmers and private users who are exempt from all the requirements of the Clean Air Act, which is what this OSHA law is under. So by OSHA essentially forcing these companies out and into private ownership, they're taking the regulation away. It's completely counter to what their intended purpose is, and it's creating a lot more risk.
Representative Kiefer.
If I continue, then this phase out of anhydrous will create another problem for our oil industry too, then, won't it? Because they won't have a use for that part of the product again. It might be a different area of your expertise, but I think it creates another problem for the oil industry too, but now they won't be producing, the anhydrous. So now where's that product go now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiefert, I don't think this is essentially going to be a phase out. Personally, there's still going to be plenty of anhydrous in use around the state. What we'll probably see is consolidation of the industry. So like the large corporate players that have the ability and the funds and the safety people to write these programs, they're going to come in and buy up all these small dealers that can still be profitable. There will still be some anhydrous, but without a doubt, there will be much less. And then that also creates supply problems on the dry and liquid chemical side because, it takes two semi-loads of dry fertilizer to equal one semi-load worth of nitrogen and, 3 to 4 of liquid to equal one semi-load of anhydrous. So that's that much more product that has to go out into the marketplace to satisfy that need. And, you know, we have supply problems with dry and liquid fertilizer already. So, and that's going to be that many more trucks on the road. You can just keep drawing lines and distinctions of how this is going to trickle down and affect everything. And, you know, again, it's going to be more, not only do we have farmers that are going to have trouble getting the product from a facility, but it's also going to, you know, those costs are going to be pushed off on the farmer as well. And so they're going to be paying more for anhydrous ammonia, and, you know, margins are very tight the way it is. So it's, this is a big deal.
Any other comments, members? Eric, you made reference, and I was told that if you have if you're an individual farmer and you have your own storage tank, or maybe two farmers together have a storage tank, they are exempt from this rulings?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. When the chemical is held in storage and used by a private user for their own personal purposes, they're exempt from all the requirements of the Clean Air Act. They still have to be licensed by the state, and you know, they still have to be inspected like any dealer by us, you know, as far as the requirements of the facility, their safety valves, hoses, everything like that. But as far as the safety program requirements, the written maintenance program to ensure the ongoing mechanical integrity of the facility, the emergency response program to, you know, coordinate with their local responders to minimize the consequences of a release, that all goes away. That's something that farmers are not required to do.
And that also is not dependent on the size of the storage tank either, correct?
That is correct, Mr.
Chairman. As long as it's being used for their own usage. Senator Lewick.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Delger, then what happens if that farmer or that partnership or group or whoever, private end users, end up selling to the neighbor down the road one tank of anhydrous? What happens in that case?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lewick, that, you know, essentially they make one sale, they're selling to someone, their retail facility, then they would have to have a risk management and process safety management program and abide by all those rules. So, you know, that's something that is going to be very hard for us to police, because we have to enforce that risk management program. So, you know, that's going to be something we're going to have to deal with in the future. One of the things we've seen with facilities selling to farmers and groups of farmers is they've basically already thought of a workaround for this. So the farmers will go together and buy a tank and get it licensed, and but they're still buying their product through the local co-op who has a fertilizer distributor's license. And essentially, you know, that co-op is still selling anhydrous to the farmer, but they're making them store it and handle it themselves. So that's one of the things we've already seen happening as a workaround to this new regulation.
Any further comments?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Delger,
yes.
I think if you put the task to any farmer and to be ingenuitive in any type of a thing like this, you're going to get something figured out that maybe regulations are not in favor of, because that's just the way that we think, so, which is good.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lewick, I grew up on a farm as well, and I would agree with that statement. Just one last note on this, since we're on the topic. I believe I got some information, an update from Senator Heidkamp's office yesterday, and she, along with Republican Fisher from Nebraska, they're going to be introducing a bill, hopefully later this week, that would force OSHA to rescind this policy and only address it through rulemaking. There is also currently a lawsuit from the Ag Retailers Association and the Fertilizer Institute. They're hoping to get a ruling on that any day now, within, you know, weeks. And then also on the appropriation side, both the Senate and the House committees have recommended language be inserted into the labor appropriations bill that would delay the implementation of this rule for another year. But, you know, that won't go to vote until September. So that's as far as what I know right now that might possibly stop it by October 1st.
Okay. Members?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I would just hope that the federal government can scale it properly. It's just the result, this whole thing is a result of one arsonist that killed 15 people, injured 160, and blew up about 150 buildings in that one facility. Well, hopefully, you know, we can get it to where it's just for great big, you know, those types of things, those facilities, so that we're not bothered so much. I would think there's a pretty good chance of that. I hope so. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Eric. Any other questions? Okay, we'll take this particular bill. We'll move it up the ladder. Let's look at one more, and then we will quick break. We are at 11:10, I think, or the 1:10.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we are now going to be looking at tab number 35. And we are now on a first version of a bill, and this regards this bill is regarding the statutory provisions that deal with the powers and duties of the commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, this draft is one that we have sort of held off on doing. The department suggested that we wait with this one till late in the process in case there were things that needed to be added. As it turned out, there really weren't any significant suggestions for changes. What it is the chapter that relates to the powers and duties of the Agriculture Commissioner. The first section of the draft relates to a couple definitions. And we have mentioned in the past that at some point in this chapter, we should probably define commissioner to mean the ag commissioner or the commissioner's designee or authorized representative. Commissioner is used throughout current Title 4.1, and now a lot of that has been transferred into the new title. The new Title 4.1 and the old Title 4. And, I didn't count how many of those chapters define commissioner to have this meaning, but it's inconsistent. And it appears to me to be best to have this provision defining commissioner for all of the ag title in one location. If the committee approves this, when we are putting the bills together for final consideration, or perhaps we can do it through code revision, a lot of those definitions over and over and over, or lack of definitions, would be resolved. We could probably take some of those definitions out of some of the bills that have been drafted and considered already. But anyway, I think it would really clean up a lot of usage through a whole lot of different statutory provisions. The other provisions in here, as you can see by flipping through it, these are existing provisions of Chapter 401, and the changes are minimal. They don't require a lot of cleanup. If you flip to page 4 of the bill, there's a provision that we kind of raised our eyebrows when we came across it. And as you can see, it's overstruck here in the middle of the page about the Ag Commissioner keeping records of the Commissioner of Immigration. I'm not really even sure who that is, but it appears that this provision was put in law back in the 20s to in some connection with encouraging people to immigrate to North Dakota. Anyway, the records that were to have been kept have not existed for a long time, and it appears there is really no reason to retain this provision. Getting rid of it, I guess, could be viewed as substantive, but I think a better view is it's obsolete. It doesn't do anything. There's no point having it on the books. So that's why it struck out. The other provisions in this chapter, they're sort of random. Some of these probably could have been thrown in that miscellaneous agriculture chapter, but for whatever reason, they ended up in this chapter for an Ag Commissioner. Bottom of page 8 is one that many of you will remember from 2011 about horse slaughter. That is transferred with this new chapter. Grape and Wine Advisory Committee, that's fairly recent. Pipeline Restoration Reclamation Oversight Pilot Program, that's fairly recent. Some of these didn't require much revision because they're not all that old. They were drafted and scrutinized by more modern eyes than some of these old laws we've come across. Anyway, this one is mostly just changing some cross-references and moving the Ag Commissioner chapter in as the first section in the new title 4.1.
Yes, Representative Cotier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. John, on page 2, section 3, is that old-fashioned there when it says the commissioner shall cooperate with any railroad company doing business in the state when it's in the titled Exhibits at the Fairs?
Am I
Section 3, I'm sorry. Section 3, it's...
Section 3...
On line 3.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Talks about the exhibits of products and resources of the state.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Trottier. No idea why that was ever put there, but if we ever have an exposition in the United States, I suppose the commissioner should cooperate.
But it, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, and to cooperate with any railroad company, in reference to the railroad company, with these exhibits. Is that from probably the 20s when they were shipping livestock by rail?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Trottier.
Okay.
I can't even imagine when that would have come into play.
Right.
Certainly before our time.
When's Wild Bill or right. Barnum coming with his train? Right.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may continue.
Go ahead, Senator Representative Trottier.
On page 7, I probably haven't read through the whole thing, but line 4, the committee may accept gifts, grants, and donations of money, property, and services. That seemed like an odd statement.
Referring to the committee. Oh, the Sustainable Ag Committee. Mr. Chairman, Representative Trottier, it is an odd statement, but it's one that appears in a number of places in code.
Really?
And it's thrown in there with the assumption that people are going to donate a lot of money to whatever this thing is, and just in case it happens, it allows use of it. Whether that money actually ever materializes, I don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
And that's a fairly new section, sustainable ag.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Is in that part of that, Senator Miller? Yep. Any other comments, questions? Council, are you, we have that covered, everything covered in this?
Yep, yep, okay. I think so.
If everybody's okay, we'll just move this up. And so I guess the question at this point, we're at 10 to 12. You want to quick take that one more, then come back at 1 o'clock? Okay.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, the next one on the list is me as well. This is, it's a bill you don't see very often. It relates to revisions by the code revisor. And when I tell you why, you will appreciate it. As you can see, we've got 13 things on the list.
What number?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Section 90.
It's, the LC number is 90.
Section 90.
So tab would be 90. Yep. The reason for this draft is that in the prior 8 years of agricultural law revision, as chapters were moved into the new Title 4.1, they were spread out incredibly far. There's a chapter 4.188. We aren't going to get anywhere close to 88 chapters. And as a former code revisor, I hate gaps in numbering because it always raises a question, why is there a hole there? What's missing? What used to be there or whatever? So the point of this draft is when the changes recommended by this committee are incorporated in the new ag title, squeeze all of the chapter numbers together so they're sequential and there aren't any gaps, and try to place the chapters in logical placement within it by subject matter. So you don't have a pesticide chapter here and another one way over there, so that they flow from one to another, and then livestock topics are sequential and so on. This bill doesn't really amend any laws. It just tells the code revisor when the 2017 session ends and the bills recommended by this committee have been enacted, and I'm presuming they will because the committee's scrutinized them like crazy and everything's good. When the code revisor gets to the point of putting those into the new chapter, the code revisor also takes the chapters that are on this list and renumbers them and changes any cross-references in the code that might exist according to these changes. Now, that's kind of an imposition on the code revisor, but I won't be here, so it's not going to be. Anyway, it's a lot easier now with computers than it used to be when you had to do it with your eyes. Finding all those cross-references and fixing them. So I don't think it'll be a big imposition. It won't slow down publishing the code. What we'll end up with is a nice new Title 4.1. And then the second section of this bill, just a little dangling thing there, repeals Title 4.
Title 4.
Otherwise, what we would have in the code forever is every heading of every chapter in current Title 4, and it would have to be preserved there saying when it was repealed and so on and so on. This means clean all that out. All that will be there is a reference. Title 4, repealed by whatever, 2017. And it'll still be possible to research back and find what's there. We've left a nice trail that people can follow. So that's the point of this bill. And the thing I mentioned is, if we didn't do this, what we would need is 13 more bills.
Okay.
Comments? And those would be really boring bills.
Comments, members? I think when the whole process started, I'm an assumption that they weren't just taking topic by topic. They were taking a whole group topics, hit and miss. And so this big spreadsheet was laid out and trying to fill in the gaps. And maybe in the end, all this would be closed up. Why it was done at that point, it makes sense. So to me, it makes sense. And members, if comments, we will mark this as approved. And then we will we'll take a dinner break, and let's come back at 12:45. That'll work for everybody. And now you're leaving it before 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock.
Excuse
Representative
me, Mr.
Larson.
Mr. Chairman, I need to leave by 2, but at the lunch, I'm driving my car down to the house and getting dropped off. So I think I can make it in 45
minutes. Can you make
minutes.
It? Okay. We will wait till you get back. Okay, Representative Larson. Okay. If not any further questions, thank you, community members, and we'll see you at 12:45. We'll go ahead and bring everybody back. At that point, if you want to, we have a series of steps here that has to take, but if you look at the back of your handbook, the very last page, there's a color-coded council will explain us the color codes and the direction at that point. So, John, you want to take it from here?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, committee members, if you're looking at the chart that has coloring on it, just want you to know I colored that by myself. And I never scored well in coloring at school, so. Yeah, I didn't stay in the lines, but I'll admit it was me. Now, to explain the sense of this thing, the first portion, about two-thirds of the page there, is intended to reflect the chapters of the new Title 4.1 that will be placed by this committee. Now, the blue ones, if you look down, the bottom part there where there's a whole bunch of blue, over on the right column, a lot of them are all LC-90. It looks like a lot of chapters, but that's the bill that we just looked at that does the redesignating of chapters that are already done. So it looks like a lot of stuff there, but it's only about a page worth of actual bill drafting. I've tried to break the committee's work into 4 bills instead of 35 bills. and I've tried to do it by topic. The stuff that's colored blue, I would term as administrative. Administrative in that it deals with the Ag Commissioner, Northern Crops Institute, the Poultry Division, a lot of those 90s, the Ag Miscellaneous thing, the State Fair Association. It will also incorporate the bill on county fairs, the county agent, APOC. So those are the blues. And it looks like a lot of stuff, but as I said, a good part of that is just this one-page bill changing some numbering. The green stuff all relates to pesticide or fertilizer topics. And I did that so that Mr. Delzer doesn't have to go to 14 different bill hearings. The stuff he will be dealing with will be all in one bill in front of one committee at a time. The yellow stuff is grouped by growing things. Hemp, soil conservation districts, forestry, nurseries, potato production contracts, trees for North Dakota, those topics. And then the orange stuff is relating to critters, livestock, dairy products, livestock auctions, those topics. So these are just a suggestion, but I tried to group them so that the Ag Department doesn't have people running all over the building every morning trying to find hearings on all these bills, that the people that are interested in a topic sit in on the committee discussion of that topic. Now, I did not measure out the number of pages that this incorporates, but I think it breaks down into manageable numbers. If we tried to put all this stuff in one bill, it would be a monster, and the hearing room would be loaded every day. And four bills seems like a workable number. It will be up to the chairman, with input from the committee that he seeks, to decide which chamber the bills are introduced in, but it can be two Senate, two House, or throw them all into one chamber to start with, or whatever you think is the best. But I think this would be manageable, and I think the folks from the Ag Department will be able to track it without too much nuisance. And unless somebody's got some suggestions, what I would suggest at this point would be, if these color coding things are agreeable, that the committee consider directing that those 35 bill drafts in our grain bin be combined into four bill drafts based on the coding coloring on this chart.
Okay. So moved. Thank you, Council. Senator Miller, comments?
I would move as directed by John Walstead.
We have a move to take all the rewrites that we've done. You know, we had our four little bins, and so to agree to this, it makes broken down to four different categories. We have a motion from Mr. Miller. Do we have a second? Senator Lewick, there's a second. Any comments, members? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I think what Mr. Walstead has done here is good. I I would suggest putting them all in one chamber, just, and then the, you could have 2 days of hearings, and then if, you know, because some of this will probably interest certain groups a little bit, and then they're all here, you know, because they come from Fargo or they come from wherever in the state, and I just think do it all in one chamber. That's my suggestion.
And that, you know, that'll be well taken, and thanks for that portion of that. I think some of it's going to look at their own calendars between the two chambers on where, if one isn't being loaded at all, then maybe they should. And when you think about it, those groups that come across the state, if they can coordinate between the two chambers, maybe they can go back and forth a little bit and solve that. So point well taken, and we can further discuss that as we go on. But right now, we're just looking for, does it take council, does it take one motion to put it in those four categories, or do we have to designate four separate bill drafts, administrative and so on?
I've always been of the mind that the simple approach is the best, and this chart sets out what the contents of four bill drafts would be. So I think one motion is adequate, and to say of having to do another motion, I would expand this motion by tacking on at the end and recommend it to the legislative management.
Okay. That's the final report, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, we'll need another motion on that.
Okay.
If this is approved.
Senator Miller, are you okay with his additional motion and second?
Yep.
Okay. Any further comments? Everybody understands how we're proceeding forward? Okay. If there's no other comments, we'll have a roll call.
That'd be motion two. Representative Onstad.
Yes.
Representative Brabant.
Yes.
Representative Hunsker.
Yes.
Representative Kiefer.
Yes.
Representative Larson.
Yes.
Representative Trottier.
Yes.
And Senator Louie.
Yes.
Senator Bowman.
Yes.
Senator Erbley.
Yes.
Senator Miller.
Yes.
Senator Murphy.
Yes.
Well, that carries.
Thank you, Council. Now we'll go one step further to a motion basically directing Council and the Chairman to finalize the report for legislative management, which is in place in the middle of November sometime.
So
we have a motion by Murphy. We have a second. Second by Senator Bowman. Any comments one way or the other? If not, we will have a roll.
Representative Onstad.
Yes.
Representative Brabant.
Yes.
Representative Hunsker.
Yes.
Representative Kiefer.
Yes.
Representative Larson.
Yes.
Representative Trottier.
Yes.
Senator Luick.
Yes.
Senator Bowman.
Yes.
Senator Erbley.
Yes.
Senator Miller.
Yes.
Senator Murphy.
Yes.
Well, I carry two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Council. Senator Lewis.
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering about if that, not this last motion, but the one before, also included that Legislative Council would also then perfectize these bills so that everything in them is correct, also in the best manner.
Good point. And in combining these into four bills, there will be some things that need to be changed. One is definition of commissioner is now going to be in the first section of the title, and it defines it for the whole title. We can take out some of the definitions that are in there. Another is this committee has reviewed and approved some bills that just repeal a chapter. That's all they do. That bill, the LC 90, has that repeal of the whole title in it. So we really won't even need to mention those bills where the committee has approved a repeal of the chapter, because we're repealing everything. So that can be left out. But the report will reflect that the committee looked at those chapters, reviewed them, determined that repeal was appropriate. So it's not like we forgot to do it. We'll write a report that makes everything look like it was well considered. And it has been. I'm not saying we're bluffing.
And the repeal is all within the scope of our committee assignment, correct?
Yep. Remove obsolete provisions. That was okay. Part of the charge. So.
Okay. Comments, members? First of all, I want to thank council. They did a remarkable job, because they're the ones that went through the order. They're the ones that did all the reading and changing this word to this and so on. And this is duplicate. So I appreciate their work, and members, for your attentiveness. We know it. I think we learned a lot. Reason why we need to look at these rules and update them, because there's old ones on the books, and even we recognize now that there's some that are probably worthwhile having a discussion in the session to really look and change. But I appreciate your work and being part of the committee, and my vice chair, Senator Lewick, and if everything's okay, council, I look to adjourn.
Sign and die.
Sign and die. I'm not expecting any songs, so have a good day.
Oh, wait a minute. Oops. We needed a vote on that one.
Do we?
Yeah.
Not in Robert's Rule of Order.
Well, this would be irreversible.
Okay. All in favor of adjourning, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
And it works.
You can hang on to these if you want, right?
Yep. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we've been storing the binders for you throughout the process of the interim committees, but they are your binders, and so if you want to review them in anticipation of session, you're welcome to keep them. I don't know what the process is if they don't, but...
I would say if you don't take it home, we will consider that to be your intention. You don't want it anymore, and it'll probably disappear. But I think it might be handy to have when session rolls around and you want to refresh on why it was there.